All right, welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate. And we got a packed show today, and I'm going to try and squeeze it all in, including very quickly running through what it's going to be. At the back end of the show, we'll be speaking with writer and actor Lucy Alabar, and we'll be talking with her about her latest play, a play she's actually staging now, called Throw Me on the Burn Pile and Light Me Up. And we're going to be talking with her about what's behind it, what she's done, and what the hell's going on there. Before that, we'll be talking with Jen Marlowe. Jen is the author of I Am Troy Davis, and we'll be talking with her about the five-year anniversary of the execution of Troy Davis by the state of Georgia, and basically what's happened since then and what she saw as the... She has an argument that the execution of Troy Davis is something that really opened up a lot of the situation that we're looking at today in terms of the people rising up against a lot of police murder, police brutality. But opening this show up, I'm very pleased to welcome back to the show Carl Dix. Carl is a representative of the Revolutionary Communist Party. He's a frequent guest on the show. He's also an advocate of Bob Vakin and his new revolutionary advances in the science of communism. And basically, we're talking with Carl now about something that people have been very, very aware of, and that is the just these last week and a half, the three murders of black people for simply being black, and in different parts of the country, one a child, 13 years old. Two others being two men that were actually going about their daily life. One had a broken down car and one was waiting to pick his daughter up from school. And they got killed. And this has opened up a lot of questions for people, a lot of response in the places where it happened, especially in Charlotte, North Carolina. Carl, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me on again, Michael.
Yeah, well, it's always a pleasure to have you on. On the other hand, it's not a pleasure to have you on about the things that's actually going on, because it's so damn enraging, man. If it doesn't make your blood curdle these last couple weeks, there's something very, very wrong with you. And like I was saying, over the last week and a half, the police have murdered three black people that we know of, 43-year-old.
Yes, we know of. There are probably more, but mm-hmm. there are these that we know of. 13-year-old Tyree King in Columbus, Ohio. A couple days later, Terrence Crutcher in Tulsa, Oklahoma. And you see the video of him walking down the road with armed cops at his back and his hands in the air. And you see him with his hands on the car when they blow him away. And then Keith Lamont Scott here in Charlotte, North Carolina, where I am right now, a man who was sitting in his car waiting to pick up his daughter from school. He gets accosted by police and he's killed, murdered, blown away by them. And in all of these cases, the lying machine, that is police department public relations, goes into motion. The media spreads the police story. The whole system goes into motion to back them up. And look, people have been calling this out, standing up against it, working in all the ways that the system says work to deal with it, trying to elect more progressive officials, electing black officials, calling for the police to be better trained, calling for the Federal Department of Justice to come in, body cameras on the police. People have filed suit against the police. And in all of this, whatever people have done to try to change it, it keeps happening. It continues to go down. And it's right in your face, and it is just unacceptable. People are right to stand up and refuse to accept this. You know, and here in Charlotte, there's been a lot of focus and condemnation of people for violence in the protests. And look, the violence is the violence of the police that's unleashed by this system. That is what's the problem that's at the heart of this. That is what must be gone at and what has to be stopped. Don't talk to me about somebody broke a window in a police car, so we have to condemn their violence. Let's get down to the heart of the problem, and that is that the police are the frontline enforcers for a system enforcing the inequality, degradation, and misery of that system. And look, it's got to be stopped. It's got to be gotten rid of. And it's going to take revolution, nothing less, to do that, because police murder and police brutality is built into the very operation of this system. It's like Bob Avakian, the leader of the Revolutionary Communist Party, says, the role of the police is not to protect and serve the people. It's to protect and serve the system that rules over the people. This is a fact. This is true. And we have to understand that and act on it.
That actually leads me right into what I did actually want to talk with you about, because, you know, it is something when you're looking at this and you're looking at all the people that are out there in Charlotte and everywhere, and people, you know, are looking for answers to this. And the point that you were just raising is, look, people go through this all the time and they try. I mean, it really is. It really is. People do really try. It always amazes me the capacity, the seemingly endless, but it isn't endless, but the seemingly endless capacity of people to try and find some way to deal with this and some and all kinds of ideas and things like that. But there's something really missing here. And that is a huge topic right now. All these solutions aren't working, but why? Why aren't they working? And you just started to speak to that. Can you expand on it a little bit more?
Yeah, I think we just have to come down on it. This is really built into the fabric and framework of this capitalist system. I mean, you look at the situation today, and you've got a system that has no future to offer millions and millions of especially inner city youth, especially Black and Latino youth. The jobs that their parents and grandparents worked in are gone halfway around the world where they could find someone that they could exploit more viciously. The educational system has been geared to fail these youth. And what you get from this system is not some way to transform itself to provide a future for people, but a way to control these people that they have nothing to offer. And that's the role of the police as the frontline enforcers. And working through the system to try to deal with that problem is working at the edges of it, and even worse, because it takes people in a wrong direction. And when I'm here in Charlotte and seeing people, I was out with hundreds of people last night. We marched through downtown Charlotte. People were righteously angry about the fact that there's video of the police killing Keith Lamont Scott that the police and the city refused to release. And they want to see this tape, and they were demanding it. And they're right to demand it, but we got to go beyond that to see that this is a system that we're up against. This is a systemic problem flowing from a system that does not work in the interest of people. And that takes us to, well, what do you do about it? You make revolution. You get rid of it once and for all. And look, that's a tall order. That's not something that's easily done and not something that should be lightly jumped into. But all of this experience points to that inescapable conclusion. And then here's the other thing. Revolution is possible. There's a basis for bringing people into a movement for revolution in the ways in which this system attacks people, but also in the ways in which people are standing up to resist it, fighting back against police brutality, trying to take on what's happening to our immigrant sisters and brothers, the attacks on women, the wars for empire, and the devastation of the environment. So there's a basis for it, and there's also leadership for it in Bob Avakian, the leader of the Revolutionary Communist Party and the party that he leads, in the new understanding, the new synthesis of communism that he's developed. You have a blueprint for a future society where the horrors of today are done away with in the Constitution for a future socialist republic in North America that Avakian authored and that the party has issued. And people need to get with this revolution, and that's something that we are working on right now. We are organizing people for an actual revolution because that's what's needed. There is every basis to make it happen. What's needed are people who see these horrors for what they are, want to see them ended. They need to get with this revolution, and we're working to organize them into it right now.
Let me ask you a question that steps back for a minute, but then goes right to where you're at now, too. You know, one of the things that actually oftentimes people kind of look at things and they say, well, people didn't rebel here. They did rebel here. And the people talk about the need to rebel against injustice. And I know that it's not like, I mean, I know that you would uphold people rebelling against this kind of injustice. But you also, there's something that I thought was very interesting that I was reading on revcom.us the other day that talked about rebellion's important, but it also has to be rebellion that's actually linked to this other thing that you're talking about, the need for an actual revolution and the actual building for an actual revolution. How do you see that relationship?
Look, rebellion is very important. Rebellion and other forms of resistance as well are very important because if people don't stand up, if people aren't working to fight back against these attacks at the powers that be and rock the powers that be back, they will beat us down so far that we'll never be able to do anything about what they do to us. But we got to get beyond rebellion. People have stood up. People have resisted for decades here in this country. They have fought heroically, but they haven't been able to break through and get to what the actual solution is and make that solution happen. And that solution is revolution. So if that resistance isn't connected to a movement for revolution, if it's not connected to a force that's organizing for an actual revolution, bringing to people why we need a revolution, how we could make a revolution, the leadership that we have for this revolution and what we need to do now, then people's resistance will end up being for naught. It won't break through, and the system will continue to bring down horrors, if only in new forms. You know, like, we look at the lynchings of black people back in the day, and people fought against that. They fought against it, and white mobs led by the Ku Klux Klan no longer lynch black people in America today. That's not mainly what's happening. The lynching that goes on is being done by the police officers who are the frontline enforcers for this system. We don't need to just get a new form for the horrors to come in. We need to end them. And that's going to take revolution, nothing less. And like I said, we are organizing right now for an actual revolution. We've got the leadership for it. We've got the understanding. I mean, and just on this understanding point, I'm in Charlotte right now, but in like 2 weeks, I'm going to be back in New York together with Cornel West. We're going to be launching Bob Avakian's new book, The New Communism, the science, the strategy, the leadership for an actual revolution and a radically new society on the road to real emancipation. That's going to be an important development for it, organizing for an actual revolution. But that's what people need to be looking at. That's what people need to be becoming a part of, and that's what we're organizing people to get into, because they need to stand up, they need to resist, they need to rebel, and we need to not let the system get away with condemning the rebels as going too far, as not being patient. Because, look, you're patient, you're waiting for the system to give you an answer. Its answer is going to be further misery, brutality, and degradation. That's all it can do, because it's based on exploitation and oppression, and it cannot not do that. We need revolution to end this stuff once and for all.
Mm-hmm. Listen, man, one more question here. One, you keep talking about making an actual revolution, and I want to know, I have some thinking on that, but I want to know what you think, and because I think a lot of people might be sitting out there and saying, yeah, revolution, man, yeah, revolution, and yeah, an actual revolution, but what do you mean by an actual revolution?
Yeah, this is important, because revolution is something that is getting more in the air these days. I mean, I talked to a couple of students. I met them for the first time yesterday at a college at Charlotte, and I read to them the statement on police lying, murdering police, running amok. And when I got to the point about we need a revolution, they were like, yeah, sure, we need a revolution. Let's go and get this statement out. And as they're getting the statement out with me at the rally, they're like, what is a revolution anyway? And an actual revolution is one that overthrows the system, meets and defeats its organs and institutions of violence, oppression, and gets rid of its economic relations and the relations among people, the social relations that it enforces, and replaces them with a totally different and far better system with new economic relations based on a socialist system that operates to meet the needs of the people, not to line the pockets of a rich and powerful few with increased profits that are wrenched from the sweat and the blood of the majority of people around the world. That brings into being a new way for people to relate to each other that's based on cooperation and collaboration and not domination and suppression. Mm-hmm. And it's been transitioned to a full classless communist society where exploitation and oppression are things that people can read about in history books. I mean, just looking at this problem of police getting away with murder. We should live in a society and a world where those people we entrust with public security would sooner lose their own lives than kill or injure an innocent person. You know, this is a point that Bob Avakian brings out in his book Basics. And that's the world we should live in. But we live in a world where when the police murder somebody, the system tells you we should give the police the benefit of the doubt. The trained law enforcement personnel should get the benefit of the doubt. That is not the kind of world we should live in. We got to make revolution to get rid of that world. And it's got to be an actual revolution, one that is aimed at getting rid of this system by overthrowing it, getting rid of its relations of misery, degradation, exploitation, and oppression, and replacing them with new ones. And look, this is important, and we have put out two important statements that get into this in different ways. One of them is how we can win, how we can really make revolution, that talks about why we need a revolution, what we need to do now, and how it would actually be possible to make a revolution in a country like this. And then before that, there was a statement we put out, it's time to get organized for an actual revolution, that talks about the problem, the solution, what to do today, and then talks about lists six principles to live for, to fight for, and even to die for. Because people have to be getting into the revolution, have to be putting it on the line to end these horrors. You know, and people are already putting it on the line in the resistance that they're waging. I've watched people here in Charlotte heroically in the face of the local police, the state police, the National Guard, people being arrested, people having tear gas thrown at them, people being brutally beaten down and arrested. A lot of heroic resistance, but we got to tie that to and make that a part of solving this problem by getting rid of the system through revolution.
All right, Carl, I want to thank you very much for joining us today. And actually, where can people go if they want to check out more about what you were saying, about the book, The New Communism, about all the stuff that you're just laying out now, the statements and all this? Where can they go?
Yeah, I'm glad you posed that question. They can go to the website, revcom.us.
Okay.
That's how they can find all of that material. That's revcom.us, revcom.us.
All right, Carl Dix, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me on, Mike.
All right, talk to you again soon. Take care. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we've just been talking with Carl Dix from the Revolutionary Communist Party, who is now actually he's in Charlotte, North Carolina, as part of the protests against the police murder of Keith Lamont Scott and all the stuff that's going on there, and pointing out the need for people to actually really start considering and really start moving on the fact that what it's going to take to actually end all this is a revolution. And that's what Carl was advocating for and calling on people to check out. So do that. We're going to take a quick break and be right back with Jen Marlow to talk about Troy Davis. So let's stay tuned.
1989. 2009.
Innocent. Not guilty.
I'm innocent.
Not guilty.
I'm innocent.
Not guilty. He innocent. Not guilty.
Free Troy Davis. Wow. All of this amazing.
Oh, yeah. For 20 hard years, he been wrongly accused. I'm talking about Troy Davis. Let me bring you the news on how the dirty DEA broke all the rules. Spencer Lawrence playing the game to make sure you lose. If you pick up the paper and you check the news, they don't got mad at me. I ain't broke no rules. I'm just talking out loud about your backdoor caper. It's court documented, so these facts on paper. So let's get it straight. I ain't scared of y'all. Martina showed the proof on the news at the hall. So now it's time to sit back and take that fall. I got a big mouth, number. Tell it all. How you mapped out your artwork, your frame and all. You retire while you're still giving Chisholm a call. Got a question for you. You a man of mouth. You're getting mail from an eyewitness to your house. Not guilty.
All right, that's Free Troy Davis from E-Red. And that came out when right at the height of people struggling for justice for Troy Davis before this system just stood up and executed an innocent man who had fought for not only his own life, but for the life of all of us, and for, in a certain sense, for the humanity of all of us. And joining us now to talk about Troy Davis and his impact on this, the 5-year anniversary, is Jen Marlow. And Jen was I have to say she was one of the outstanding and the foremost voices in the fight for, you know, working with Troy's family, but really dedicated a huge portion of her life to actually fighting for justice for Troy Davis, fighting to stop his execution, to get him freed. And she was relentless. And she had a big impact on me, I'll tell you. It was very, very, very important. She's also a very well-known and busy journalist around the world talking about Palestine, other parts of the Middle East, and all kinds of things. Jen, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Michael. Great to be back on with you.
Yeah, yeah. It's always good to hear your voice, you know?
Good to hear yours as well.
Okay. Well, that's all we got to say, son. That's it. Let's jump in. Let's jump into this. It's the five-year anniversary of Troy Davis's murder. For people who aren't real familiar with the situation, let's give a quick breakdown of what are we talking about, Troy Davis's murder?
So Troy Davis was an innocent man on Georgia's death row. He was convicted in 1991 of the 1989 murder of a white police officer in Savannah, Georgia. And he was convicted on very flimsy evidence. There was never any physical evidence that linked Troy to the murder. There was no murder weapon ever found. He was convicted solely based on the testimony of eyewitnesses, of which there were nine. Seven of those nine eyewitnesses later recanted their testimony, many of them saying they had been coerced and intimidated by the police into implicating Troy. So whatever case they had against Troy at trial, flimsy as it was, totally collapsed post-trial. But because of how the system works in this country, the justice system, which is not actually about seeking justice, which is actually not about trying to seek truth and fairness, but prioritizes finality over fairness and certain kinds of time limits you have to appeal and introduce certain kinds of new information, the system continued to rule against Troy until ultimately he was murdered by the state on September 21st, 2011, which was 5 years ago. But in the time, he first got an execution date in 2007. So Troy had actually survived three prior execution dates before the state finally did manage to kill him. And in those years, an international movement really grew around Troy's case that Troy himself helped to spur, and especially his older sister Martina was fighting tirelessly and advocating tirelessly for her brother's freedom, for his innocence. And because of her efforts, she was really able to get human rights organizations finally to look at his case and to see that it was an egregious violation of justice, as so many cases are. And they got on board, organizations like Amnesty International, the NAACP, the ACLU, Southern Center for Human Rights, many other organizations. Media began to pay attention, and Troy and Martina found themselves really in the middle, not just of a campaign to prove Troy's innocence, but in the middle of a fight against the death penalty, with the recognition that the death penalty is the sharpest and most lethal edge of a very violent and damaging criminal justice system.
Mm-hmm. Now, just for people that aren't all that familiar with it, I want to add something here, which is the campaign that you were talking about is something. What developed around Troy Davis and the fight, the international campaign to save his life? You make this point in your article, but I think it's important for people to understand. This was unprecedented in a lot of ways for an anti-death penalty case. There was this, you know, for this amount of people. And I do remember, I mean, if people think back about when they were murdering Troy, that the people that flocked down to Georgia, they flocked to the site of the prison. They flocked there. They were making their voices heard in whatever way they could. This was an unprecedented flowering of just opposition and anger, but really people demanding justice, even all the way up to the moment of the murder of Troy.
Absolutely. And I think it was a very, the movement that grew out of Troy's execution or the movement that was bolstered by Troy's execution, I think it's important and unprecedented in several ways. And one was the scale of it. It was global. There was, like you said, people were flocking to Georgia to protest and to stand with the Davis family, but there were protests all over the world in the leading up to and in the aftermath of this unjust killing. There were protests in France, in London, all over Europe, in Asia, and in cities and states all over the United States. There was actions and protests. 51 members of Congress actually called for clemency for Troy, President Jimmy Carter, the Pope, even Bush FBI director William Sessions. I mean, it was really unprecedented in many ways. And I think that there was a lot of ways in which the outrage that came from Choi's execution and the disappointment that so many folks felt in Obama. This was one of Obama's first tests, I think, for a lot of Black folks. A lot of Black folks that I've talked to about their own response to Choi's execution, folks who talked about believing that Obama was going to represent the hope and change that he had campaigned on. And this was, for many of those folks, the first test of that. People were waiting for Obama to intervene and waiting for him to stand up for an innocent Black man who was being murdered by the state. And Obama's silence and Attorney General Eric Holder's absolute silence, I think the deep disappointment in that is part of what fueled the outrage and part of what primed people to respond the way they did then a few months later when Trayvon Martin was murdered by George Zimmerman. And it set off a series, you know, cascaded into a series of seeing these young Black men being killed by state, being killed, agents of the state, or like in the case of Trayvon Martin, vigilantes, but who the state then let off the hook. And I think it set into motion all of the events that led to the Ferguson uprising, and it set into motion, you know, and then everything that grew out of the Ferguson uprising and the reemergence in this form of the movement for Black Lives. You know, all of it is directly connected to what we're seeing playing out on the streets of Charlotte right now. Troy's murder was a part. I don't want to say that it started, that it launched that movement, because as Troy said, it was never just about him. There was Troy Davis's that came before him and Troy Davis's that came after him. But the response to his execution, the movement that grew to prevent his execution, and then the response of outrage to that execution, I think played a significant role in what we're seeing happen now as far as the movement for Black Lives is concerned. It also fed directly into the Occupy movement. There was a march right after Troy was killed. There was a day of outrage called in New York City, and people met in Union Square and held a rally, and then they ended up marching downtown to Zuccotti Park, where occupiers had taken over Zuccotti Park and renamed it Freedom Park. The people marching in the day of outrage for Troy merged and joined with the occupiers, who also were protesting. And that was the first night that there was violent police attacks on the Occupy Wall Street encampment, which is what drove media attention to the encampment. So in many ways, I think it's fair to say that the Occupy movement might not have become what it did had it not been for Troy's execution, because it was the anger and the outrage and the passion coming out of that execution that led to those first clashes with law enforcement, where law enforcement brutally repressed the encampment. So there's a lot of impacts that Troy's execution had and continue to have.
Mm-hmm. Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and today we're talking with Jen Marlowe. Jen is an author, documentary filmmaker, playwright, and journalist. She co-authored the book I Am Troy Davis with Davis, who was executed by the state of Georgia in 2011, as we're talking about, and his sister, Martina Davis Correa. I have to say, Jen, there's something that you said in your recent article, which people can also find this article, The Execution of Birth, the Movement, in These Times. And you
correct.
Can,
yeah. And co-written with Keyonde Yamata Taylor, I want to mention.
Okay. Yeah. And there's something that a young man that you interviewed, and the guy that opens up the story, that he said that really I found very moving and very, very, and worth considering and talking about. He said that talking about what happened, the impact of that, the impact of Troy Davis being killed, and the impact of this, basically everything else that happened. He said that Troy Davis cracked the screen of reality and Trayvon Martin literally shattered it. And when you think about that, that's a pretty heavy statement to make in relation to where are things at among young Black people and among people who are concerned about what's happening to people now here and all over the world. That's a pretty heavy statement to make about the link of those two things. I thought it was very poetic, but also very, very important for people to understand.
Absolutely. And I think, and the young man's name was Jordan Taylor who made that point. And I think, Jordan was talking, I think there was many layers to that statement of what he meant. And I think one of them was his belief that the system, was largely a good system, but that it was broken and that it needed to be fixed. You know, that was what he had previously believed about the justice system, about the system in general, that it had problems, it was broken, it was, it was flawed, but that it was an inherently a good system and needed to, and those those parts of it that were broken needed to be fixed. And when Troy was killed, that was the first time that that notion really got challenged, and that there was a, you know, a big crack in the screen, as he said. And then several months later, when Trayvon was murdered, then that shattered that notion for him. And that's when he began to doubt those beliefs when Troy was killed. And by the time Trayvon was killed, he was really at the point where he understood, no, it's not that the system is broken. The system is not broken. The system is actually functioning precisely as it was intended to. It was planned and built to function this way. It was planned and built to privilege certain lives and to devalue other lives, primarily, of course, the lives and the bodies of Black folks and brown folks. And that was the realization that began to dawn on Jordan when Troy was murdered, and really hit home when Trayvon was murdered.
Mm-hmm. You know, one of the things that I also found very interesting in your piece, too, is you speak a lot to social media. And in something, when you think about actually what has happened since Troy's murder, you know, you think about that and the flowering, the flow, and particularly in terms of in political circles and around political causes, the role of social media. And a lot of that also was like really, you know, I'm not going to say, oh, it was created at that point, but it really took a leap in terms of its being widespread and what was being said on it around the time of the campaign against the murder of Troy Davis, right?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the use of Twitter as a form of protest and the use of hashtags as a form of political consciousness. Troy's execution was one of the events that crystallized that. In 2011, at the time of Troy's execution, hashtags related to Troy, hashtags such as Too Much Doubt and I Am Troy Davis, were at that point the most frequently used hashtag in Twitter's history. Now, of course, that has since changed, of course, and there's been other hashtags and other subjects that have been tweeted about even more than that, but that was a really significant turning point for how social media could be used to really spread, not only spread a social justice message, but spread a protest, spread awareness that, hey, y'all, we're going to have a rally, and it's going to be at this time, and you know, showing people where to go and where to show up. It was one of the early ways in this country that was used. It's really fascinating to see, you know, looking at Twitter and social media, also how that's been used, how that was used in the Egyptian Revolution, how that was used in the Bahrain Revolution. That's, you know, that's a whole interesting subject in and of itself. But certainly, Troy's execution was one of the key times that social media was harnessed for that type of cause. And then, of course, that became even more refined and more used when it came to the protests and the response with Trayvon's killing and with Mike Brown's murder and all the subsequent events.
Mm-hmm. All right, we're running out of time, but I wanted to ask if you had any more comments you wanted to make on this that would actually, because, you know, I mean, you actually, in your article, you also talk about the thing of the impact of Troy's murder and the struggle against that on something like Black Lives Matter and on the policy, you know, developments of policy for Black Lives Matter, and in particular, the opposition to execution across the board. You want to comment on that for a little bit?
Yeah, I mean, I guess one thing I want to say is that I think it's being recognized in the last several years in a way that it maybe hadn't been as recognized before, that the death penalty is an egregious violation of justice and an egregious violation of human rights. And that, I think, has been recognized for quite some time. But I think it used to be looked at as almost in a silo, as if it was its own thing, that the death penalty was its own very horrible thing, and that we had a fight against it, and then once we could get it abolished, our work would be done, and we could go home. I think there's now really a recognition that the death penalty, I might have said it in this way a few minutes ago, is really the sharp edge of a damaging and violent criminal justice system, which in and of itself is a part of a larger system and structure of state-sponsored violence, which includes the police killings that we're seeing happening so rampantly, which includes mass incarceration, stop and frisk, mass surveillance, all other forms of state violence, which particularly target Black and brown bodies. That the death penalty is part and parcel of that whole system. And so I think the movement for Black Lives has really recognized it. I think it's not a coincidence that some of the folks who were the authors of the policy platform that came out this summer with from the Movement for Black Lives, the Vision for Black Lives, some of those folks have been very active in campaigning against the death penalty. And I think it's not a coincidence that one of the policies that the Movement for Black Lives calls for is the abolition of the death penalty, and that there's an understanding. And I'm paraphrasing a quote from someone in the article, Tenjie Ray McCarrick, where she where she says, I hope I get the quote right, it's not in front of me, but that, you know, a world that values Black joy, Black life, and Black resilience cannot be one that has the death penalty in it.
Mm-hmm,
and
exactly.
The understanding of that connection, I think, is becoming more and more apparent.
Exactly. All right, Jen Marlow, thank you very much for joining us today. And is there a way people is there a way people can get in touch with you, or do you have your website or whatever?
Yeah, my website is donkeysaddle.org. So donkey like the animal, saddle like what you'd ride on the animal's back, .org. And my email is jen@donkeysaddle.org. Twitter at donkeysaddle.org. Yeah, be happy to correspond with folks.
All right, and I look forward to talking to you again soon, Jen. Take care, man. All right?
You too. Great to be on your show, as always.
Thanks. See you
Bye,
later.
Michael.
Bye. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we've just been talking with Jen Marlow, an author, documentary filmmaker, playwright, and journalist, and we've been talking about the five-year anniversary of the execution of Troy Davis and the impact of that on the world and on all of us, all right? So we're going to take a quick musical break and be right back to talk with playwright Lucy Alabar about her amazing new play, all right? So stay tuned.
Don't it make you wanna go home? Don't it make you wanna go home? All God's children get weary when they roam. Don't it make you wanna go home? Don't it make you wanna go home?
All right. Yeah, that's Swamp Dog with Don't It Make You Want to Go Home, all right? And it just kind of really hit me after seeing this play, Throw Me on the Burn Pile and Light Me Up. Not only is it one of the funniest things I've seen in quite some time, it's also one of the most moving, and there's actually a way that it cracks open your head at just the precise moment. It's one of the most moving and deeply personal plays I've seen, and it also manages to wrestle with big ideas, outlooks, and really makes you think. And in just a few minutes, we're going to be talking with the writer and the performer, Lucy Alabar. But before we talk with her, I'm going to play a short reading from the play, which is available on YouTube. And the play, again, is Throw Me on the Burn Pile and Light Me Up, a one-person play set in Grady County in the Florida Panhandle. And it covers about a year in the life of a young girl, Lucy Alabar, all right, beginning in the summer before fourth grade. Her father is a lawyer who represents indigent defendants, and that summer she's recruited to help out in her father's office when the secretary has to go away suddenly. So here's the reading, and then we'll be right back with my interview with Lucy Alabar.
Daddy's burn pile is 400 times the size of my daddy. It's bigger than our house. Daddy's burn pile is dead vines, dead trees, furniture daddy broke in his rages. It's all the files for me and daddy's men come and gone. Mama says Daddy's burn pile is a liability. It's so big and dry, and our house is so wood and dry, and our field is so long and dry, and there's all this lightning. But Daddy says, no, boss lady, saving my burn pile for my funeral. In this fashion, the matter is settled. We behold the mighty burn pile. Daddy says, boss, I'm gonna put you in charge of my checkout time, because the boss lady loves her Jesus too much. Daddy says, boss, when it's my checkout time, I want you to take my tractor and put it in front of my burn pile. And then I want you to take my Seminole's hat and put it on top of my banjo. So it's like I'm sitting in my tractor, but instead of my body, it's my banjo. And then just have a big party, play some good music, some Peter, Paul, and Mary, smoke some ganja, and then just throw me on, light me up. No crying, no Jesus.
All right, that was a little sample of the play, Throw Me on the Burn Pile and Light Me Up. And I'm very pleased to be welcoming to the show the author of that piece and of the play, Lucy Alabar. She's also known as the writer of, and I'm just going to get this out, Lucy, so you'll have to put up with it. You're also known as the writer of Beasts of the Southern Wild. And I did see a link between those two, so welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Sure. You gave me a good time. Now I'm gonna actually torture you and make you answer all of my questions, okay?
Oh, good.
What the hell were you doing? What were you thinking about? Yeah. Anyway, you know, it's kind of that's I've always wanted to ask somebody that from the beginning.
Yeah, that's a great question.
You know what? As I was watching it, I did. It just sort of overwhelmed me. And it was both, you know, funny as hell. It was really funny. But it was also so damn moving. And, you know, you're laughing and you're also your eyes are tearing up. But it's because there was so much in there. One of the things I wanted to talk to you about first is it took me a little bit of thinking to, and maybe it's just because I'm dense, but it took me a little bit of thinking that this actually was very much a song for your father. And it was really, really, you know, even the thing that gave birth to your whole play had a lot to do with something you recognized about your dad. And it brought your dad in a way that your play brings the humanity out in all these other people. In a way, it seemed to bring out your dad's full humanity to you.
Yeah, that's such a beautiful way of putting it. I will definitely make him listen to this because he'll get a kick out of it. But yeah, absolutely. I mean, this play really began the day that I learned that my dad, who took on all these very violent, really unpleasant, for lack of a better word, death penalty cases, I learned that he's present with his clients for their executions as a, you know, a last witness or just somebody to be there with them so they won't be alone. And that was so, I still haven't found the words exactly to talk about how that made me feel, so I had to write a whole play about it and torture myself and my director for about 3 years to figure it out. But I think I finally cracked it.
Yeah, you got it. I'll give you that. Yeah. You know, and the play, I mean, really, the play is, as I was saying, it's really funny, but it's also so damn heavy on many levels, you know. Not just in relation to your dad, you know, but there's also the stuff that he teaches you about humanity and other people, which I thought were, you know, you slipped them in there, and there were always lessons learned or lessons given at times when you didn't expect them or didn't want them. But you actually, there were very important things in terms of what he helped you to see about other people.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, my dad really opened my eyes to the need to be not just be a witness, but this idea of ministry of presence, which he hates. I think that's a Catholic term, and he would hate that. But this idea of sticking up for the underdog, and he talks about defending the little guy and being a champion and defender for the lowest people in our society.
Yeah, and insisting that they actually have as many rights and that it was important. And the thing, there's a couple of places in the play that you actually, as a little kid, you're like, what the hell is this big girl picking on me for? I want to go over and poke her eyes out.
You know?
Give me a big stick, man. But there's a way that, so it's interesting the way that what you learned, how you actually managed to control that, but also what you learned about that in terms of, you know, the humanity and inhumanity and in terms of a whole approach to life.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's part of growing up, and it was certainly something my dad instilled in me very early, but this idea that when people inflict pain on others, they're often coming from their own place of pain, and there can always be vengeance, but the way to actually end that pattern is to reach out and identify the need and the hunger and the pain that act of violence comes from and begin a dialogue with that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
And it's obviously much easier said than done, and that's obviously not something I have the perfect solution for, but it definitely opened my eyes in terms of watching my dad's work with criminals. Absolutely helped me to this day, really. It helps you deal with difficult people in general, you know?
Mm-hmm. But there was something actually that was very important about this thing in terms of your dad actually doing that stuff in relation to criminals and you actually being, I mean, you weren't just, I had this vision of you as this little kid and you're like very serious. You're like the Secretary of Defense for all these people sort of. And And you're going through these cases and you're learning some things about people and sometimes very disturbing things about people who weren't, you know, mischarged, but the fact that they were being executed was not right. And people who had like, you know, a 30 IQ or something and people who had mental illness and stuff. But you actually, on the one hand, you're horrified by that, but you're also having to deal with the fact that your dad, for some reason, is staunchly defending these people. And I thought that was a very important thing about a statement. Again, this thing, the importance of trying to fight for people's humanity, trying to fight for that and against anything that's actually going to rob people of that. And that was something I got a big hit from you when you were actually going through the files and secretly, you know, sort of looking at, and which, by the way, what was the phrase you use? The top secret?
Oh, that everyone, Oh, under top security.
Yeah, right.
That's how you have to do everything in my house, under top security.
Well, people have to understand. Well, let's talk about what I was just asking you, because, and then I'll actually pose this. Don't let me forget. There's something else I want to pose to you about this, but
sure.
Under top security. So let's talk about that, though, the thing about this constant sort of, you see what this is, but your father actually really, not he insisted, but insisted in a way that actually helped you see, rather than just sort of like, don't question me, just do what I say.
Exactly. Yeah, I mean, I think, especially growing up with my dad, he did take measures to prevent me. He practiced law out of our house, and so there were pretty gory crime scene photos and pretty hardcore police reports that were free for perusal. You know, I mean, that were just left out and open. And yeah, I think my dad did try to protect my childhood and all of our childhood by taking care of that when he could. But I think for him, it became so normalized, and for us, it became so normalized that even now, when I talk about these cases and I do this play for audiences, I'm still surprised at how shocking some of it is, because it felt very standard in a way growing up. Not to minimize the extent of the damage to anybody's lives, but it really did feel normal. I mean, I've heard, especially other girls or women who are raised by fathers who deal with pretty hardcore modern world problems, either they're in the military or they're in law enforcement or they're just from a hard life. And the ways that they prepare their daughters for the world is often to really insist they know more about it and be fully educated instead of sheltering them. And that was a really important thing my dad did for me that I've found. Now that I'm doing this show, I have other women coming to me and talking about their military dads or dads from a hard life doing that for them as well.
Mm-hmm. You know, but the things that you learn too, even in terms of this, I mean, I have to say, I occasionally went through the South as fast as I could. You know, and I spent some time.
Yeah. Totally understand that.
The billboards down there really scared the hell out of me. Okay.
Tell me about it. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, stop, drop, and roll won't work in hell.
Right, is
a good one you see sometimes. Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely. First billboards in the South are their own special phenomenon. Yeah, I definitely get that from a lot of people who've never been to the South or say they drive through quickly, and look, I mean, if you look at what's going on right now, it's completely understandable. And I one of the ways that I'm hoping my work can engage and change is that I think the South needs to have a really hard look at itself and a look at what we're built on and look at how we want to move forward united instead of so divided. I mean, your caller earlier said such interesting things about really acknowledging as a country and in the South our past and moving forward based on that knowledge.
Mm-hmm. You know, one of the things too, and I have to say, I should remind people, even though it's getting close to the end of this, I should remind people that we are talking with Lucy Alibar, who's the author of a tremendous new play, and it's called Throw Me on the Burn Pile and Light Me Up. And you know, people wonder, what the hell is the burn pile?
Oh, okay. So for someone who has not been to the South or Texas, which doesn't, if you ask people from Texas if they're from the South, half the time they'll get really offended but Texas, like the South, does burn piles or burn buckets. It's basically our version of recycling, where you throw all your junk out onto a pile, or if you're feeling classy, into a bucket. And, you know, when it gets full or too big, you set it on fire. And it's my dad's big funeral plan. So he's been planning his funeral eagerly since before I was born. And he has this idea for a big kind of Viking funeral without the water. It sounds pretty grim, but he gets such joy out of planning his funeral that we all sort of go along with it.
Yeah. Okay. You know, my family never went along with it. I would even practice. I would lay down perfectly still and try to stop breathing for as long as I could just to practice.
Absolutely. I mean, he has the whole thing planned out, the playlist. He's always amending the playlist. I don't know if I'm allowed to talk about ganja on the radio, but
sure.
He wants a fair amount of ganja and beer and everybody to have a really good time.
There you go. One of the things, and I do have to say this, is that one of the things that really struck me about this too, though, is that all the stuff that you were talking about your dad and this wackiness, and I mean, folks, listen, you have to get this. Lucy is talking about a family, a place where her brother is known as Son of, and has his deepest friendship is with an egg. Okay.
Yeah, I love that egg.
Yeah. I'm not even going to ask if he still carries it around. I just don't want to know.
No.
And her mom sprays their dog, which is, what is the dog's name?
Nice dog.
Yeah.
And one of the five. One of the many.
You have five dogs?
Now we only have four, but we always had a steady stream growing up. Mom would just pick them up off the highway and make them a part of the family. And when they had mange or if they just smelled bad, she sprays them down with Febreze, which is her favorite cleaning product for everything. Like when she discovers that Febreze uses it to clean and to freshen the house and to spray on the dogs.
That sounds a lot like the people I live with. Okay.
Absolutely. It's cheaper than Dr. Broner's. It's basically the same thing.
Right. And with big dogs, you know, big dogs get dirty and smelly and there's nothing you can do about it.
Definitely.
There you go.
Definitely.
But they are part of the family, as are, in your case, a lecherous goat, which I have to say, that was
Carl.
The most.
Carl.
Yeah. Yeah, Carl is one of the most sexually active creatures I've ever heard about.
Oh, Carl was bad. Yeah, Carl's a bad goat. I mean, I don't know if all goats are like that. All male goats of a certain. I don't know. My mom came to see the show, and after the show, she gets really angry because she loves Carl so much, and she says, "Don't malign Carl, and all these people are going to think Carl's a bad goat." And I just told her, no, everybody just understands Carl. I mean, Carl is beloved, but she just said, well, roosters are worse.
Yes, I agree. Roosters wake
they
you up.
Are.
Yeah, they're terrible. Oh, man. I was in Southern Africa for a while, in Botswana for a while before, and then.
Oh, wow. Places.
But yeah, this was a long time ago. But one of the ways that I got woken up the first morning I was there, I was staying in a house, and there was no glass in the windows in this house. And so I'm laying there, and all of a sudden I feel this and this sharp thing landing on my stomach. And I look up, and there's this giant rooster staring at me. I thought, this can only lead to terrible things.
Absolutely. You're lucky that's all he did.
Yeah, I know. I was very worried about that. And yeah, we won't go any further on that because anyway.
Exactly.
Anyway, one more question, the set. Actually, I'm lying. There's another set question after this, but the set is remarkable in what it brings to the thing, and I just found it to be because there's a magic in what you're doing there, and in a certain sense of what you're bringing together and the way that you're telling a story that actually has many, many intensely serious moments in it. The whole relationship between you and your classmates and what you learned about that, and the humanity and inhumanity that's constantly posed there, and I thought you've come out in the play, you've come out in the on the side of actually recognizing the importance of recognizing people's humanity and shaping your life in relation to that. But the set really added to that because it opened up a whole thing of sort of a world that was just sort of magical and amazing that you were living in.
I'm so glad to hear you think that. Yeah, my director, Neil Keller, works with Tak Kata, our designer, on many, many shows. And I think Tak is absolutely a genius. He's a real artist. I mean, he's a real visual artist, and he'll stare at something, and he's very quiet, but then he just slowly but surely built this beautiful, incredible set. It really does feel like art. It feels like you get to play around on art every night. It's incredible.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can imagine. And one last question. We'll have to be a little bit quick on this, but again,
sure.
this point of, one of the things that I was really moved by is that I read somebody describe this as a frenemy, but there were so many people in your class, and it'll amaze people when you talk about like how IQs were taken and the struggle that people had to actually even have a platform in society of any fashion.
Uh-huh.
And one of the things I found really moving was the way that you actually, with your friends, and you learned a lot of lessons from friends that you even thought hated you or that beat you up, and also and friends that you tried to help that actually ended up having terrible consequences to that. But it was very... That was very important to me in terms of just your character as it developed. Can you talk about that for like a minute or so?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's something so interesting and compelling to me always about returning to childhood and looking at those dynamics, because in childhood, unlike in adulthood, the kid who beats you up is also going to be, they'll also have your back in another hour, and then you'll also be best friends, and then the next day that'll change. And it's so there are ways that you're almost like dogs without a memory of, you're very much in the present as a kid. And so the social dynamics are so interesting and fascinating to me. And you're, as kids also, you're each other's protectors, you're each other's parent surrogate sometimes. You're each other's teachers, and it's just, the world of childhood, especially in the rural South, is this never-ending playground for me.
Mm-hmm. All right. Lucy, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Sure. I had a lot of fun talking with you. Not as much fun
you
as I had
too.
Seeing the play. The play is not, I go to bed dreaming about it. All right. Anyway, Lucy, thank you very much for joining us, okay?
Thank you,
all right,
sure. Have a good day.
You too. Bye,
bye
now. All right, before we go out, there's something I want to read to you that I think is actually very appropriate given the season we're in, the electoral season. Every 4 years, we get this major electoral season, and particularly after the airing of the first debates between Clinton and Trump, I thought that this is especially important for people to hear. It's from Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party, and it's taken from his book, Basics. When a monopoly of political power and, in a concentrated way, the monopoly of legitimate armed force is in the hands of one group in society, and that group excludes others from that monopoly of power and force, then that is a dictatorship of the ruling group or class, regardless of whether or not that ruling group allows those it excludes from power and over whom it rules in fact to take part in elections to vote for different representatives of the ruling class, as happens in the U.S. and a number of other countries. Political rule in the U.S., regardless of whether or not there is an open and undisguised tyranny, is and always has been a bourgeois dictatorship, a dictatorship of the ruling capitalist class, or, in the early history of the U.S., before the defeat and abolition of the slave system through the Civil War, what existed was the dictatorship of the ruling classes, the slave-owning as well as the capitalist class or bourgeoisie. And again, that's Bob Avakian, chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party, and it's taken from his book, Basics. All right, I'm Michael Slate, and this is the Michael Slate Show, and I want to thank everybody today. And I want to thank my board offer today, Teddy Robinson. I want to thank my assistant producer, Henry Carson, my production assistant, Jeff Pryor, and each and every one of you for tuning in. If you want to write to me, you can at mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. Once again, that's mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. And as always, you can find the links to my guest websites on my Facebook page even as we speak. Talk to you again next week.